Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
If you've been to the National Gallery of Australia in Canberra, you've probably made your way to what could be the most famous or perhaps infamous painting in it, Jackson Pollock's Blue Poles. Back in 1973, the conservative Australian media and plenty of members of the public were scandalised that the gallery, with the express permission of then Prime Minister Gough Whitlam, had spent $1.3 million to buy it. At the time, it was the highest price ever paid for a contemporary American painting. Well, time's proven that the then gallery director, James Mollison, made an excellent decision. Today it's worth at least $100 million, and I've seen estimates of up to $350 million. And in 1998, it was the centrepiece of a Jackson Pollock retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. So what makes gallery curators and directors choose the pieces they do? What kind of competition do they face when they're purchasing them? Do they go head to head at auctions, giving each other the evil eye? What are some of the great pieces that were purchased? What are some of the stories of purchases that didn't go so well? Well, you're about to hear from two gallery curators who are going to tell us some of the stories about how they find the pieces that end up in our art galleries, our museums, design places. Lucina Ward is a senior curator at the National Gallery of Australia. She's joined us from our Canberra studio. Hello, Lucina.
Good afternoon, Suzette.
And Roger Leong is senior curator of the Applied Arts team at the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney, where he works mainly in costume and fashion. Roger and Lucina previously worked together at the National Gallery, and one of the stories that they're going to tell you is about what a smart decision the gallery made when it purchased the costumes of the Russian Ballet back in 1973. And I should say we've put up some photos on our Facebook page of some of the pieces we're talking about tonight. So if you're curious, look for Nightlife ABC Radio on Facebook and you'll be fully prepped for the discussion. Roger, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Roger, I guess it's the big expensive purchases that galleries make that end up making news and being in the headlines. But you think it's important for people to understand that most of what's in the Powerhouse Museum, for example, is actually donated.
Absolutely. I don't know exactly what percentage, but I'm comfortable to say 75% of what we have in the museum is donated because we simply don't have the funds to buy everything. And we have such a broad collection, and a lot of our collection is about technology, domestic appliances, technologies, health and medicine, as well as decorative arts and design or fashion and textiles. And there are plenty of examples out there in people's homes and private possessions or in companies. And at some stage, because they are kind of applied arts and sciences, they lose their utility value and people will approach us.
Become a museum piece.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. Lucina, is it this similar with the National Gallery, or do you find you purchase many more of the pieces that we'd see if we went to the gallery?
I'd have a difficulty in breaking down the proportion. It would be less, much less than 75%, but certainly we have a very generous public out there. And in helping us to tell both the story of Australian art and put the Australian art in context, in a world context, particularly in the Asia Pacific region, but with often with reference to Western traditions, it's just amazing what people have out there. And the gallery's history is really important because the National Gallery started relatively late in the scheme of things, and because the National Gallery is publicly funded, it was determined that it should not compete with the other state galleries, nor indeed with the Powerhouse or other publicly funded institutions. So that's the reason why the collection in Canberra is emphatically modern, looks at the avant-garde traditions, but also, you know, provides that larger context internationally and globally to both traditions and across a whole range of disciplines. That we were fortunate in some ways that in starting late that we didn't have to stick to a kind of 19th century or earlier ideal of what art is, you know, which basically meant old master painting.
Mm. Well, that explains why Blue Poles was something that was acquired fairly early on, something like that, rather than, you know, we're going to seek out a Van Gogh.
Well, yes, exactly. But it also meant that the gallery could be very opportunistic in its purchasing. We'll come back to the story of the Ballet Russe collections, but also to incorporate art across all different mediums and disciplines. So, you know, a fantastic collection of the history of photography. Some decorative arts and designs, although in a slightly different brief to Roger's collection, but also with a view to looking at the way in which artists and art makers across a whole range of disciplines, time and cultures can be represented.
So, Lucina, take us back then to 1973, when the gallery, as we've just said, was fairly new and you had this idea that it's modern art that we're going to buy. What made James Mollison, who was the gallery director then, see blue poles and say, this is an important purchase for the gallery, we're going to try to do this?
So the whole conception of the National Gallery goes all the way back to the period of Federation in 1901. But we're kind of lucky that we didn't actually start collecting in earnest until the 1960s and 70s, because the intention was to be a very different sort of gallery, to be a gallery of the portraits of the founding fathers. And in the 1960s, they developed this idea that the Australian National Gallery, now the National Gallery of Australia, would represent beyond the work of Australian art. But the idea that the gallery should do something quite different, so global art of the modern period was spoken about. And the gallery was fortunate in that it had a champion in the form of James Mollison and an extraordinary series of artists who were involved in council. And they influenced this idea that there should be work, strong Australian collections, but broader international collection to put those in context. So something like blue poles, American art was very important, something championed by James Mollison. So all of these wonderful connections that Mollison had, Max Hutchinson, who he'd worked with previously in Melbourne, all of these key players start to influence the importance of American art. So blue poles was known, and people would visit, you know. The collection was well known and Ben Heller's connoisseurship was much appreciated.
So to those in the know, blue poles wasn't a strange or a radical purchase. It was a quite sensible purchase based on a piece of art that was widely recognised.
And it was considered at the time as one of the most important post-war American paintings still in private hands. So it was all treated fairly diplomatically, fairly privately, behind closed doors. Some of the connections that Mollison had in New York were very important. But in the end, it was a decision that Ben Heller made to sell to the National Gallery. He would have had many, many other galleries in the United States and further afield soliciting that work from him. And he decided that he liked Mollison's approach, his grand vision, the idea that the blue poles, you know, would be one of the most, if not the only, important Pollock within Australia and would form a linchpin to the collection in Canberra. So that big picture vision was very important to persuading Ben Heller to sell the work to Australia. And it wasn't just James Mollison. He was there with other representatives of the Australian government. It was a pretty tough deal, as far as I can tell.
You know, this all happened before I was born, but you grow up hearing about this controversy about blue poles. When you look back at the media coverage of the time, how big a deal was the money that was spent on the painting?
Well, it's probably worth pointing out initially that, yes, it was a lot of money. It remained a record for Pollock for quite some time. But the currency conversion rates were in our favour, shall we say, at the time. So 1.3 million Australian was 2 million American. So that actually gave the gallery, it's worth noting, a certain amount of buying power, both in the United States and further afield.
I bet you long for those days again.
We do indeed. And it's also worth pointing out that because of the lobbying by the artists and the other business people and on the board at the time. The National Gallery of Australia was actually one of the richest institutions in the world at the time. There had been decided that, you know, this was going to be an important institution and certainly one of the richest institutions without a building. So all of this extraordinary work that was done behind the scenes achieved a great deal. But of course, like anything in Canberra, it came with a certain amount of spotlight too. You know, a director in most cases would probably recommend not disclosing the price for a work of art, and particularly a major work such as Blue Poles. It inflates the art market, it encourages unnecessary attention, you get all sorts of offers all around the world, some good, some not so good. But in this case, Whitlam approved the purchase, as he was required to do for amounts over a certain amount, and wrote, "Disclose the price."
Right, so he wanted everyone to know what had been paid for this.
Yeah, and, you know, the work became an extraordinary work of art in its own right, became to represent the new outward-looking role of the Whitlam government at the time.
On Nightlife, we're talking with Lucina Ward, Senior Curator at the National Gallery of Australia, and also Roger Leong, a Senior Curator of the Applied Arts Team at the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney. Roger, do directors and curators ever take a punt on artists that they think one day might be famous, or would that be too speculative?
We do it with great caution, and generally we like to see a little bit of a track record, but sometimes there are standout performers, like the designer Mark Newson, for example. He was trained in Sydney at Sydney College of the Arts in jewellery. He exhibited his final year work, I think it was in 1986 or something like that. And in that exhibition, he displayed his famous, what we now call the Lockheed Lounge, you know, that wonderful sinuous sort of drop of mercury sort of look.
So this is the aluminium, the yes. Fiberglass. It's a chaise lounge. It doesn't look like it's comfortable.
Well, I can't comment because I've never actually had the pleasure of sitting in it.
Is anyone allowed to sit on it?
No, we're not allowed to sit in our museum objects.
Obviously.
Yeah, but you can watch Madonna in her film clip Rain reclining in it. It certainly exudes the idea of kind of sinuousness and comfort in that sense. It looks like it might be comfortable, I don't know. But it's this very unique piece, and it really kind of caught international imagination pretty soon after he exhibited it as a student, as a graduation student.
But you purchased, some of his items prior to the Lockheed Lounge?
We did purchase some of his pieces prior to purchasing the Lockheed Lounge. So the museum did take a punt. They bought some early chairs. They even commissioned what is known as the embryo chair, which is also similarly sort of embryonic and sort of globule-like in form. It's this kind of beautiful pink polystyrene shape with these kind of aluminium legs. And the museum commissioned that, and it was made in 1988, so not long after he graduated, for an exhibition called Take a Seat at the Museum. And, we were probably the first museum in the world to commission something from Mark Newson, you know, still in Sydney at the time. And then we actually ended up commissioning him to make or have the Lockheed Lounge made in 1988. But it took until 1990 until it was actually acquired. The lounge took at least 6 months to make. And he only ever produced 10 of that second edition.
So you commissioned him to make that lounge, which he made 10 of and which were then sold around the world.
They're sold around the world, yes. And they're now considered, that Lockheed Lounge is now considered the most sought-after, desirable piece of furniture by a living designer in the world. I mean, one sold, I think, in 2014, I think, in the US.
Is this the $4.69 million purchase?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, and we certainly didn't pay nearly that much for it.
Does it matter, Roger, if the price goes up, or does the price signify the cultural importance of the piece and reinforce its importance in your collection? Does that matter to galleries and museums?
Well, look, we kind of don't, you know, the value that we ascribe to a particular piece is more about its contribution to design history or scientific history or social history. And as curators, we weigh all those things up. And sometimes we might place just as much importance on an everyday item, like the dolphin lamp, for instance. You know, just about every Australian family had a dolphin lamp at one stage in the 1970s. So we've got that lamp, but also all the design development that was used to create it. Look, it's very heartwarming to know that our collection is valued, not only in terms of a monetary value, but valued by the rest of society. So it's good to know that when we do spend a little bit of money, that it's been wisely spent. But we would never have the luxury of spending $4.7 million on a piece of furniture, unfortunately.
But, Lucina, I'd imagine for all the naysayers when Blue Poles was purchased, that the fact that you can say, look, it's at least, you know, worth $100 million now, that that goes some way towards being able to say to those people, look, this was a good investment, or does it matter?
Look, it can persuade some people. It's not usually the tack that we like to take. I mean, like everyone, we have to pay insurance premiums and...
So going up in value is not necessarily a good thing then.
You know, in the past there have been upsides to having a collection that increases in value. In some ways it's nice to be the second most valuable financial resource in the country apart from the... military. But on the other hand, as Roger said, you know, we like to put the emphasis on the importance that art and objects of design and decorative arts and material culture more generally can bring to people's intellectual and pleasure.
Now, you were both involved with exhibiting the Ballet Russe costumes, costumes from the Russian ballet. Now, I remember the last major exhibition was 2011, I think. Tony Delroy, who used to host Nightlife, took the show to Canberra and took some of our listeners on a curated tour through the exhibition. But, Roger, you curated an exhibition of the costumes in 1998, and this is a great story about, I guess, a very smart acquisition by the gallery. Lucina, why did the gallery decide back in 1973 to acquire these costumes that had been worn by the Russian ballet in its formative years?
It was for two major reasons, partly because the emphasis in the collection from the very early stages was not on fine inverted commas art, you know, not the old master paintings and not paintings per se. It's part of the reason that the sculpture collection at the gallery, for example, is so strong. But it's also got a connection back to a whole series of incredibly important 20th century visual artists, Matisse, Picasso, Goncharova, just to name three. And that's what the Russian ballet, that's what Diaghilev and others were doing that was so important. So, you know, we've got the idea of ballet in the traditional tutu sense being a very important part of Russian, French and broader European culture. But what was happening then is that the Diaghilev and others were in effect breaking open these ideas, and they were, instead of taking a fairly traditional approach to the stories, to the music and to the costumes, they were approaching these key and major visual artists of the 19th and 20th century to be involved in the design of the look and feel and the costumes, so much so that some of the costumes were much disliked by many of the premier performers because, of course, they were very difficult to move in. But, you know, it was a very radical and new approach to what ballet could be, and very much intertwined with the whole idea of kind of being a complete work of art. So the moving works of art on the stage that the dancers would wear, the backdrops, and indeed coordinated with the music, etc., were really what gave the Ballet Russe their extraordinary reputation. But going back a step, the artists were, and the Ballet Russe were incredibly important in the teens and 20s and 30s, but there was a period when they became less well-known. And the acquisition of the first group of costumes in the 1970s and 76, pardon me, was before a lot of major museums had started to take note of this material. So that was very clever purchasing. I mean, I think it's somewhat exaggerated, but I've heard some of the conservators and previous curators say that they were really buying a bundle, a series of collections of costumes that were almost grouped together, and it was really only when they arrived at the gallery that they were fully catalogued. And
was it almost a lucky purchase then, or was the person who actually made that decision very, very clever?
A bit of both. A bit of purchasing ahead of the market, a bit of knowing what was out there. And just by way of example, you know, I mean, these costumes rarely come up these days at auction. There are smaller groups of accessories or objects that relate to particular costumes. But it's quite a treasure trove that was acquired by the gallery in that first purchase.
Now, is this correct that the price that was paid for that initial lot is about the same price as what was paid years later to buy one single costume from the Ballet Russe?
Indeed. And, well, having said that, the Goncharova Sadko seahorse is extraordinary. We should probably call it an ensemble. It has the most extraordinary headdress and you know, is an amazing piece of sculpture in one sense. But, yes, it does go to emphasise how in 25-odd years how much new attention and how much people had started to, museums particularly, had started to value the costumes. We should get Roger to talk. I was only peripherally involved and he was directly involved with this collection.
Well, the other story about the Ballet Russe collection at the National Gallery of Australia is that it has taken three decades to restore these costumes because they were working costumes. They've been sweated in, and sweat is notorious for rotting textiles. And textiles are inherently fragile anyway. So there has been extensive reconstruction, research, and so forth that have taken place over three decades that have not only physically restored them, but also restored their cultural value because the particular dances that are connected with particular costumes have been discovered, you know, sometimes they have the names in the costumes, sometimes they don't, and the particular kind of importance to those particular the roles that those particular costumes are associated with. And then the extensive deconstruction, a lot of these costumes have been literally pulled apart into kind of little shards of textiles and then applied onto this very fine sort of silk kind of netting and then reconstructed back again. I remember one particular costume took almost 6 months to restore, for want of a better term, and the research that goes along with that is extraordinary.
And so part of the value in it is the value that you've added with
Absolutely.
The restoration and the research and, and putting it in the context for those people who are going to come and
Absolutely.
See it.
Absolutely. Mm. Suzanne, can I go back to one other thing about
sure.
value? Because it just reminded me, you know, that question about is value important? One of our most important works at the Powerhouse Museum is the Boulton and Watt rotative steam engine. Now, it's dated, it was made in 1785, and the Boulton and Watt steam engine is one of the great icons of the Industrial Revolution. The steam engine literally drove progress in the Industrial Revolution, and James Watt was one of the great inventors of the 18th century. And this particular steam engine was made for the Whitbread and Co. brewery in the UK. And they used it effectively for 102 years. And then when it was decommissioned, Professor Archibald Liversidge of the Sydney University approached Whitbread Brewery and asked if they would consider donating it to the Powerhouse Museum, which was then called the Technological, Industrial and Sanitary Museum.
Sanitary?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they agreed, and the whole thing was kind of pulled apart, shipped over to Australia. It was a number of years before it was put back together again and then reconstructed, and they kind of wired it up electrically to get it going. But when the Powerhouse Museum reopened in 1988 in its current site, they actually reconstructed all the mechanisms to power it as a steam engine. So there are these huge kind of steam cylinders and downstairs in the basement of the Powerhouse Museum that power up this steam engine. I don't think it is the only, but it may be one of only two working industrial era steam engines in the world. And when we have regular valuations of the collections every 5 years. And when it was valued, when the valuer came to value this particular engine, they could not give it a value because there was no comparison. Because how many industrial era steam engines come on the market?
That's right.
Particularly working ones in working order.
Mm.
So the valuer said that this was priceless But this is one of our most valued items in the collection, but it literally cannot be given a monetary value.
On Nightlife, we have two guests, Roger Leong, Senior Curator at the Applied Arts Team at the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney. Also, Lucina Ward, Senior Curator at the National Gallery of Australia. Now, Roger, I want you to tell me the story about the Enigma machine and the condom.
Well, this was an acquisition made by my colleagues, the principal curator, Matthew Connell. And he acquired the machine that the Germans used during World War II to encrypt coded messages, which they would send between themselves. And this has since become a kind of icon of the Second World War because it was featured in a movie about Alan Turing called The Imitation Game.
And it was the cracking of the Enigma code that was a massive breakthrough in World War II.
Exactly. So Turing created these kind of prototype computers, really, to crack the codes that the Enigma machines were making. And I believe one of the clues that he was given that they used was apparently at the end of every message that the Germans would send to each other, they would say, Heil Hitler, you know, so therefore setting up a kind of regular pattern which helped to kind of entrap them.
To break the code, yes.
Because of kind of official war secrets and so forth, knowledge about the Enigma machine weren't really revealed until the 1970s. So really in 1994, when Matthew bought this at a Sotheby's auction, he was able to acquire a very good condition Enigma machine for a very reasonable price. Now if you try to buy one, you would pay 10, 15 times more. And of course, it was a very exciting purchase. The then director organised a kind of press conference for the arrival of the Enigma machine. But of course, being public institutions, we like to spend our money wisely because at the same around about the same time, the museum had also successfully purchased at auction, this time at Christie's, a 19th century sheep gut condom. So the condom was consolidated in the crate, in the shipment, with the Enigma coding machine. And I think when you incorporate things such as things made out of body parts or animal parts, I think they sort of create kind of customs issues.
Right, yes.
And so the whole shipment was held up in customs, didn't arrive on time for the press conference, unfortunately.
So were the media waiting or did the press conference get cancelled?
They were waiting, unfortunately.
Oh, no. Yes. And they had to say no because we packed that condom in there.
Yes, I know.
The machine hasn't arrived. Lucina, you've got a couple of Monets in the gallery. Now, I know you said at the outset that the gallery's remit was to do something different, to concentrate mainly on modern art, but Monet's particularly classical. Why did the Monets come into the collection?
So setting up the beginnings of modern art with realism, with impressionism, with post-impressionism, etc., we were never going to have a large number of works in these areas, but we needed to give a sense of where modern art begins and these major artists of the 19th century. In purchasing the Haystacks, one of the 30 paintings that Monet laboured over in 1889 and 1990, the wonderful stories where he was starting to become relatively successful. He had the house at Giverny that remained his home and he built into that magnificent garden. But he was starting to become completely obsessed with the idea of a single motif observed over changing light and seasonal conditions. And the Monet that we have, the Haystacks in Sunny Conditions, is considered one of the best of that series. There are a lot of Monets out there, partly because he was a prolific artist, partly because he was working with this idea of series. So, you know, Monet was on the list. Mollison decided that, you know, it wasn't going to be any Monet. It had to be an absolutely well-resolved, perfect. Because, of course, this is in Australian art, we collect in slightly different ways. We need to have both a horizontal and a vertical representation of what goes on in the world of art in this country. In international art, we have to recognise that we may only ever have a single work of art by an artist. And it has to both represent their oeuvre and represent a major moment in art history. Mm. We often want to avoid a work of art going to auction if it's something that we really want that fits within our collection. We don't really want it to go onto the open market. Hopefully we're dealing with a private collector or a dealer or the artist directly.
So Roger, tell me, how do you know when things are coming on the market? What's the secret? Is it a bit of who you know, or do you get a catalogue of what's coming up?
Well, often you don't, but the best way is to talk to people, talk to dealers, talk to auction houses, talk to collectors.
So you need to have good relationships with those people.
Yes,
so they're
yes.
going to ring you and say, yes. Hey, Roger, that gumboot of Queen Victoria's that you've been looking for, I've got it.
Yes, yes, exactly. That's the only way that I know. And also talk to other curators and other institutions, because generally, I mean, of course, there's some level of competition amongst museums, but generally people are more supportive of each other than competitive to each other.
You have got up, I think, at 3 a.m. to take part in an auction.
Many times, because, you know, a lot of auctions, particularly fashion auctions, take place either in London, Paris or New York. So it's never at a convenient time.
Right. So you're what, joining in on the phone or...?
On the phone, yes.
Right.
So you have to kind of set the alarm so you're kind of not dozy when the phone rings, and then you wait for the call, and then you wait for your lot to come up.
And there's someone in the room for you raising the paddle?
Yeah, well, there'll be someone from the auction house on the phone to you, sort of bidding for you on your behalf, yeah.
Right.
And it goes very, very quickly, so it's very scary, that's all I can say.
Of course it is. So who normally wins when you, is there one particular museum that if you see them in the room, you go, oh, we're not going to get this one?
Well, look, put it this way, if I knew that the Metropolitan Museum was bidding, I probably would just give up. You know, but,
their budget's a lot bigger than the Powerhouse Museum.
Yeah, so you don't normally know that.
No, Roger, you say you're not after a bargain either. That you actually think it's really important that you are paying market prices for pieces.
Yeah, look, I think it's really important, and I think it's part of our ethical code, not only as museum curators but also as public servants, that if somebody comes to us with an object that they realise that they're being paid the market price for that object. And sometimes somebody will come to you with an object and they may not know what the market price is, but it's our responsibility in a way to let them know what the market price is, or help them to find the market valuation, because it would be irresponsible for us to behave like a kind of shifty second-hand car salesman.
Exactly.
Yeah.
On Nightlife, we've been joined by Lucina Ward, Senior Curator at the National Gallery of Australia, and Roger Leong, Senior Curator of the Applied Arts Division of the Powerhouse Museum. They've been joining us to give us an insight into how curators operate and what they're looking for. And I hope you've got a little bit more understanding of how they go about sourcing the things that they buy on, well, our behalf. Roger, Lucina, thank you so much.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, Suzanne.
Thanks so much, Suzanne.
This is Nightlife with Suzanne Hill on ABC Radio.